Mathematica to approximate functions, or to solve a partial differential equation approximately or numerically. And the idea is that, while Mathematica is very useful, there are many cases where you cannot solve something symbolically, where you cannot get an analytic solution, but it may still be possible to get an approximate numerical solution. And that, of course, is often implemented in low-level languages in Fortran, C, C++, and random large computers. But of course, there are basic underlying principles behind discretizing or solving something numerically. And I want to highlight these principles with something in Mathematica, because it's easier to do there, and it's easier to understand these principles. So, of course, solving something numerically is a really large topic, a really large field. There could be several year-long lectures on this topic alone. So this will just be a very brief introduction. But since we talked about Mathematica yesterday, I think this is a good way to continue something to show a crossover between what you can do symbolically in Mathematica and where you can do something numerically. So I have this notebook here prepared, where I have many of these equations of Mathematica commands already in there. But as we go on, I will write text into the notebook, and please tell me to do that if I forget to do that. So the notebook in the end also becomes something like a lecture note, and also to slow me down in case I talk too fast, that gives you time to catch up, and I hope that it's then easier to follow the lecture. So the main task of the main aim of the lecture today is to be able to solve a partial differential equation approximately, and we're going to do that in several steps. So let me write down what we're going to do there. First, you're going to find a way to approximate a function. There's a particular function. I'm going to represent that approximately. So first, we want to approximate functions on a particular manifold. For example, we're going to expand the function into certain basis functions and then just truncate after certain basis functions. So the manifold that we're going to use here is just the interval from minus 1 to plus 1. We're going to expand functions into Chebyshev functions. And if you have something like a sine wave of that interval, the sine wave, if you approximate that in terms of Chebyshev functions, in terms of polynomials, lead, of course, infinitely many non-zero coefficients. But the coefficients, actually, they tend to zero very quickly. So just with a finite number of coefficients, you can already do a very good job. So if you want to approximate, after approximating a function on a manifold, the next step we're going to do is we're going to look at how certain operators, for example, the derivative operator, look in these approximated things. So we're going to find discrete versions of operators. Let me say find. For example, the derivative operator. And lastly, we're going to use that, the approximately represented functions and the discrete derivative apparatus, to solve a PDE. It's a very simple PDE that we're solving here. I think I'm using the stationary heat equation, which technically is an ODE, but you can easily extend that to a PDE by using intervals that are not one-dimensional but higher dimensionals. Then you get multiple derivatives, functions of multiple unknowns, and then it becomes a method for solving PDEs. But currently here, it's just ODEs. Okay, so the first thing that we're going to do, we're going to choose a certain manifold, which is the interval from minus 1 to plus 1. And then we're going to choose a particular basis for that manifold. And then we're going to truncate the basis somewhere, and this gives us the approximation. And every function that we have is the end going to be represented in terms of that basis. So the function is represented. You choose a basis, and then represent functions in terms of their basis coefficients. So every function is going to represent it as a vector of real or a vector of complex numbers. And since we truncate it, it's a finite dimensional vector. Represent functions as for that particular basis. Actually, if I could to say here, truncate basis, because we only want to do calculations here, it's good to use only finite dimensional vector spaces. This is where the approximation comes in. And in the end, of course, if you want to find out whether this is the real solution or how good the approximation is, you need to think about what happens if you truncate the basis, if you keep more and more elements of that basis. So here, I'm going to define the basis functions. And yep, is that right? We're only going to keep four basis functions. This is what I want to say with n equals 4. The kernel starts. And I want to represent, choose as a basis the Chebyshev functions. As my basis. And here I'm just plotting the Chebyshev functions from 0 to n. And you should all, in the interval for minus 1 to plus 1. And you should all know how that looks like. So these are these five functions. The zeroth polynomial, of course, is the constant at x equals 1. There's a linear function, a quadratic function, and higher order polynomials. And the Chebyshev functions all have some very nice properties. For example, they're all minus 1 or plus 1 at the boundary. The extrema are all at minus 1 or plus 1. And well, the higher order functions, they have correspondingly more and more wiggles in them, the more and more extrema and more zero crossings. And the Chebyshev functions, they're also orthogonal. And they're actually not quite orthonormal. Let me write it down. They're actually orthogonal with respect to a particular integral. It's not just the integral from, so to be orthogonal, you need to choose a particular dot product. And the dot product here is an integral from minus 1 to plus 1. But they're not orthogonal with respect just to that integral. You need to use a particular integral weight. And actually, the definition in Mathematica, they are not orthonormal. Their normalization factor is slightly different from 1. So we're going to redefine our basis so that this normalization factor is actually 1. Let me actually move that up here, orthogonal. This integral, which I call the Chebyshev integral. So this is an integral from minus 1 to plus 1. Can you read that? It's a bit small. Integral from minus 1 to plus 1, the certain function f, f of x. And this weight factor is 1 over the square root 1 minus x squared. So that means near the bounds of the integral, near the bounds, minus 1 and plus 1, the denominator is almost 0. So these the values at the boundary are much more emphasized in that integral. So if functions differ near the boundary, the integral treats them as more differently than if they differ near the center. And there's an overall normalization factor of 2 over pi. And we can try that out. We can take the Chebyshev integral of what is that? Good. This is the Chebyshev integral. And we take a product of twice the zeroth Chebyshev function. And that should be something like 1 or so. If it's orthonormal, it's actually not orthonormal. It is what happens here? Ah, OK, I forgot the ampersand. I kept droning on about that yesterday, and now make this mistake myself. So the zeroth Chebyshev function, if you take their product, it's actually 2. And if you take the first Chebyshev function and take the dot product with itself, then it's 1. And if we take, say, the zeroth and the first, the result is 0. So the zeroth and the first Chebyshev function, they're orthogonal to each other, but they're not quite orthonormalized. And I like to use orthonormalized function. It's not necessary. The basis functions also don't need to be orthogonal to each other if you want to represent something, but it's nice. So we are now define a modified Chebyshev function that's actually orthonormal. Orthonormal Chebyshev functions. And I call them Cheb. And this is just a different normalization factor here. If I equals 0, it's the zeroth Chebyshev function. I use this factor, 1 over square root of 2. Otherwise, a factor of 1, and multiply that with the other Chebyshev function. And now they're all orthonormal. So we can test that here. So we calculate this table where I and j go from 0 to n. And we take the Chebyshev integral of the ith and the jth basis function here. And we output that as a matrix. Now that requires solving 25 integrals, which takes a second or two. And this is the identity matrix. That means the functions, these basis functions that we have, they're really orthonormal with respect to the basis. Orthonormality. Very good. So this was the ansatz. We have our basis functions, and here we take a cutoff at n equals 4. N equals 4 is rather low. I just do that here so that actually the errors in the representation are still visible, barely visible. Of course, there would be no problem at all to using 10 or 20 Chebyshev functions, or whatever, even 100 if you want it so. But you get into certain kinds of trouble then. And of course, you can also use a much lower order where you just keep two Chebyshev functions and so on. And of course, you don't need to use Chebyshev functions. You can use Legendre polynomials or other polynomials. And if you have a different basis, if, for example, you expect your function space to periodic, you would be Fourier polynomials, sine, cosine, or e to the ikx or something. This is just the basis that I choose here because it has particularly nice properties. Now, this is the basis that we choose. Next, we need to be able to take any given function and project it onto this basis. And conversely, once we have given a function in terms of basis coefficients, we need to reconstruct the function. So, approximated functions are represented as vector of basis coefficients. And then we have here a function C to F. Oh no, what? Yes, C to F. Converts such a vector to a function. And this is how the function looks like. So we have a vector CS, which is just a vector of real numbers, or maybe complex numbers. And then we take the sum of this vector CS, of the corresponding of the ith element, with the ith basis function. The Chebyshev functions are numbered 0 to n. In mathematical, vector elements are numbered starting from 1. So CS, the elements go from 1 to n plus 1, not 0 to n, which is where this plus 1 goes for. So we just take the sum over all these n or n plus 1 functions that we have and turn that into a function, which is the definition. And then, for example, we can calculate C to F of 1, 0, 1, 0, 0. Since n equals 4, we need to give 5 basis functions. And this is now a function that contains just the zeroth and the second Chebyshev polynomial. And that function looks like, okay, it's a function, so let's evaluate it at x, then it looks nicer, and that's how that looks like. Maybe we want to say square root of 2 here. Yes, 2x squared. We divide this by 2, take 1 half here. Oh, sorry, I'm trying to make that look nice. How does that work? T-I-N-N. Okay, very good. Didn't work. Maybe we add a simplify. Just wanted to look nice, right? So this is, for example, how the function x squared looks like in terms of basis coefficients. We need the zeroth and the second Chebyshev basis. And of course, other functions can also be represented, but not all functions, because we truncated the function space. This is the next function here that we have here, which is, this is just an example. This is a function, project f to c, takes any function and projects it onto the basis functions that we have chosen. And that function also truncates, because we only project on the first 5 basis functions, because we set n equals 4. That means part of the function may not be represented. So project any function f onto our set of basis vectors. And what we do, we just take the dot product of the function f with respective basis functions and put that into a table. And since our basis functions, we choose them as to be orthonormal, that's the right thing to do. If they were not orthonormal, we'd need to do something more complicated here. But this is just linear algebra, except with functions instead of just vectors. And for example, let's take an example here. Sorry, we can take f to c. What is this? F to c of, what is it? x squared, how does that look like? X squared. And what did you expect here? Yes, exactly, the one up there. And does it work? Yep, it looks good. And we can also take f to c of a sine function. And okay, apparently you get Bessel functions if you do that. But is the Bessel function evaluated at a particular number? So we can also evaluate that numerically. Then we get a numerical value. And then you see it's not actually a function, but what comes out is just this one here. And of course, the interesting thing is if you take f to c of the sine function, and then you convert that back into a function. So we take a sine function, project it onto our basis, and then we reconstruct the function that comes out. And that, of course, doesn't look nice in any way. You don't get the sine function back. Oh, sorry, I need to evaluate that at x so that it looks nicer. Yeah, so that is not a sine function, obviously, because we truncated the function space, so there's going to be an error. And in that integral, minus 1 to plus 1, the error is going to, in that interval, the error is going to be rather small, and then we have a handle on it. But of course, if you want to look at the function far outside that interval, where both the sine function and the Chebyshev functions are well defined, the error there will be much larger. But we completely disregard that, because in the beginning, we chose that particular interval as our function space. Now let's set up some, define some generic coefficients. I just call it CS. This is just Z0 to Z4. It's just some generic vector with undefined values. And then if we take this vector and reconstruct that function, then we get, yeah, sorry, I should probably evaluate that at x. Then this is the interval comes out. So if you have, the expression that comes out, the polynomial, if you have a generic vector, this is what comes out. And if we take that expression and convert it back to coefficients, then we get, this is now slow, because Mathematica needs to do, solve the particular projection integrals and so on exactly. Then you get the same coefficients back. That means our function f to c is indeed the inverse of c to f. For this choice of n, right? There's not a generic proof that we did here. Now here's a question. Is c to f also the inverse of f to c? If we take a particular function, and then convert it onto into our basis representation and reconstruct that function, is that also the inverse, or is that not? Yes, exactly. Ha, I gave it away. Ha, sorry about that. Yeah. Okay, if you do that dynamically, yeah, this happens, yes. Because there's a projection involved. If we convert onto our basis, we're projecting, we're leaving things out. This is the inverse. If we start in the right function space, if we start in the function space that is spanned by our basis, but since we truncate the basis, that changes in this case. That's not. Okay, so this is how we can represent functions numerically. We chose five basis function here, and every function is the end represented by numbers, as we did here. And of course, computers are very good at doing that. And you can represent quite complicated functions. If you, for example, were to dynamically calculate how a binary black hole system looks like, then of course you need to expand the four metric in a four-dimensional space-time. So you need to have quite a number of expansion coefficients. Also, the black holes, I mean, you only need to represent the part of the space-time outside the event horizon, but you also want to go far enough away and so on. So four Bessel functions are not going to do that. You need to use many, many more basis coefficients. And if you use a supercomputer these days, you can probably use 10 to the 9, 10 to the 12 or something expansion coefficients, which is, of course, only possible in a supercomputer. And if you want to make that work, of course, you need to know certain properties of your expansion. And you need to have certain mathematical proofs at hand, because once you have 10 to the 9 or 10 to 12 numbers, I mean, you can't print them out, you can't look at them, you can make fanciful movies. But if something goes wrong, you need to have a strong analytic handle on the approximations, the approximation methods that you're using. And this is where the R I should say, where the science in numerical analysis comes in. But I will completely skip that today. I just want to give you a basic understanding of the methods that one uses to perform these approximations and that make then such calculations possible. So here we have a way to represent, to approximate functions by choosing a basis and approximating it. But having a function, of course, is not good enough. We also need to have certain operators that need to be discretized. For example, we want to solve a PDE. And in the PDE, there are going to be derivative operators. So you know, we need to represent derivative operators also in that discrete. So we're kind of taking the discrete derivative the continuum derivative operator, and we're going to find how that operator looks like in the basis that we chose, in the truncated basis. So let me describe that here. We need to be able to okay. So what we do here, next steps, essence. I'm wondering whether the next step is too big, whether it can be broken into pieces, or whether I should do that right away. Okay, you're going to take a generic function represented in our basis. Calculate its derivative, and from that, determine that is read of the matrix representation of the derivative operator in our basis. So this is what the next line does here, but it's quite complicated, so I should probably split it into several pieces here. It's also quite slow. Okay, let's do it in several steps. So we have the generic set of coefficients that we used here, CS. I always need to hit Command 7 so that I can type text into Mathematica that then counts as text and not a cell that is evaluated. So later on, when I evaluate the whole notebook, this text that is kind of the slim black will not be evaluated and the other text will be evaluated. So we have here this is this one here, which is CS, that is this one. And from that, we can calculate a generic function, which is C to F of CS. I write at X, we had that before. And then take derivative of this function, which is C to F of CS prime evaluated at X. So you take a particular function, any function that is represented with these derivatives of these coefficients, z0 to z4. We recalculate the function symbolically, and then we take a derivative, and this is what comes out. And as you notice, the coefficient c0 does not appear anymore. And of course, that is to be expected, because the coefficient c0 represents a constant function. If you take a derivative, it vanishes. Now, we take this function, and then we represent it back in terms of coefficients. So project back onto our basis. So I say project here. It so happens to be, if you use Chebyshev polynomials, that if you take a derivative and project it back onto our basis, that it is already lies in that function space spanned by our basis. So the truncated basis that we have is closed under derivative. That's clear because we have polynomials, right? If you polynomials up to x to the 4 that we chose, and we take derivatives, they all will lie in the same function space. That's not necessarily the case. You might want to choose another basis, more complicated, where if you take a derivative, you fall slightly outside the base. In this case, you have to project back into the base. Of course, we have to think hard about what it means if you take a derivative when the derivative can't be represented exactly. That leads to all sorts of headaches. But in the real world, when you want to do something calculate, that just is the case that you need to handle correctly. And this is part of the approximation or the discretization error that you might make. But here, luckily, we don't have to take care of that. So now we take f to c of c to f, cs prime. Is that it? Looks correct. And so these are the new coefficients that we get out. And what we do now here in that function here, in the definition of dd, we call a function coefficient. And coefficient finds coefficient of an expansion something, essentially compares different terms and reads off coefficients of something. So for example, if we ask the coefficient for C1, it would get square root of 2. For the coefficient of 3, we could get 3 square root of 2 and so on. It's just reading off coefficients. There's nothing bad in here, nothing complicated in here. And then we also create a table for that. And if we output that, then it looks like this. And this is the matrix representation of the derivative operator of our modified Chebyshev polynomials in the basis that we chose. So let's write that down. This is the it's a truncated basis. And you see certain factors square root of 2 in there. I was grandiosely adding a factor square root of 2 earlier to the zeroth Chebyshev function because I wanted them to be orthonormal, not just orthogonal. And this is where we actually pick up the square root of 2. This is why the original definition of the Chebyshev functions, I assume, doesn't have this factor of square root of 2, because then the derivative operator looks much nicer. You see there's a whole lot of structure to it. You see if you go along this diagonal, there is 2, 4, 6, 8, and this would be 4, 8, and so on, instead of squeeze, what?
6, 8.
I don't know exactly. We can change n, then we have a larger matrix here. It's probably 6, 8 that comes out then, and so on. And you know that this matrix is upper triangular. That's a matrix that's rather easy to handle. And of course, there's a reason to it that this row here, for example, is 0. That means if we take a derivative of a particular representation, then the coefficient C4, the highest coefficient, will always be 0. Because the highest polynomial that we have in representation here is x to the 4. If we take a derivative, it can't have any x to the 4 to it anymore, and so on and so forth. And yeah, corresponding, yeah, there's also a column that is 0, and so on and so forth. And later on, we can also change the number of basis coefficients and see how these things then look like. I'm afraid that the way I calculate this matrix DD here is a bit inefficient. Of course, it's well known how this matrix looks like, and there are much more efficient ways to calculate that than this complicated taking a basis function, expanding, looking for excisions, taking derivative, projecting back, and so on. That's rather slow, in particular since I asked Mathematica to do all the calculations symbolically here. So there's a lot of integration and some goings on. You can do that once ahead of time, or just read it up in a book, and then this matrix here can be calculated much more efficiently. We can also calculate the second derivative, which is, of course, just the matrix product, d dot d. Oh, I'm calling it dd instead of d, because a lowercase single letter d looks a bit strange. They usually index, right? A, B, C, D, use them as space-time indices or something, and I don't like giving names that are just a single letter that just can lead to confusion at some point. This is how a second derivative looks like. There's nothing special, of course. Then you have the kernel has now dimension 2. There are 2 zero eigenvalues, as is to be expected. Now let's look at an example. Derivative of sine function. So we take the sine function. We project it onto our basis. Then we have a vector of basis coefficients. We multiply it with the derivative operator, which is the derivative. And then we convert it back into a function. So we reconstruct the respective function. Now, taking the sine function and projecting it on the function space, that is, of course, complicated. That takes time. Mathematica does that symbolically because that is where the Bessel functions earlier came in. The other things here, taking the derivative, that is essentially instantaneously. So multiplying by a 5x5 matrix, that essentially is trivial these days. So now it's spending all the time calculating a projecting the sine function onto the basis. And now we look at that, and we are plotting two things here. First, we're taking the sine function, taking the derivative directly, and show that as function of x. Or we take the d sine function that we calculated just up here, and we show that on the interval from -1 to +1. And this now gives you a visual clue about the quality of our approximation. And you see that it's pretty good, but you still see the difference. And that means the error is probably something like 1% or something, right? The whole thing is 300 pixels large, and the difference is 3 pixels or something. You expect the error is 3%. That's, of course, still much too large for many cases. But if you use many more expansion coefficients, for example, 10, you would not be able to see the difference there anymore on the screen. And actually, here that was an example for the sine function. Sorry, for the derivative of the sine function. Let me show something else. Maybe just take the sine function itself, not its derivative. Now we should probably all define it. So here, I think we calculated it earlier, but we didn't give it a name. So let's give it a name now. So we define a function sine with lowercase s, where we just take the sine function, project it, and reconstruct the function. That was the Bessel functions. And then we plot that. And here I see something different near the corners in our representation, but you probably don't because you're sitting further away. So here the error is much smaller than 1%. And of course, what I'm not showing here is that if you increase the number of basis coefficients that you keep, that the approximation does become better, and also how fast it becomes better. And this is actually, for a Chebyshev function in this case, we are getting what is called an exponential convergence. So every time you're adding one more basis functions, the error drops by a certain factor. I don't know what that factor is, which is pretty good. So if you add 6 more basis functions, the error drops by a factor of, I don't know, 2 to the 6 or 4 to the 6 or something, or 10 to the 6. So it drops really, really fast.
Eric, is the approximation worse at the boundaries? Or, I mean, if we calculated, we subtract to our sine function.
Hey, very good. I should plot that. Yes, thank you. We can show the error. We just plot our sine function minus the original function. That is the error. And you see how the error looks like. And that is very typical for Chebyshev functions. It's not worse at the boundary. The error is nicely distributed everywhere. And this is why the strange weight function was used for the Chebyshev function, because it has exactly that property. And if you look at this function, this looks actually similar to the fifth Chebyshev polynomial. And that's also to be expected, because the basis coefficients for the Chebyshev polynomials, in many cases, will kind of fall off. So the first one that we ignored, in this case the fifth one, is the most prominent one. So this looks like the fifth Chebyshev function. There are, of course, many higher order Chebyshev polynomials in there as well. And this is a particular simple function. You can try to represent other functions. In particular, representing non-smooth functions is a problem. So a non-smooth function would, for example, be a spiky function. Function is almost zero, that at one point it has a peak, for example, a very small, very narrow Gaussian or something. And then you need many, many Chebyshev functions to represent that. So if the width of the Gaussian is, say, 1/10 of the simulation domain, then as a rule of thumb, you need 10 Chebyshev functions before you even begin to represent that function. And if the width is 1/100 or something, then you need 100 Chebyshev function. And if you have a black hole with mass m and the whole region you want to represent is 1,000 black hole radii, then you need 1,000 Chebyshev functions before you even begin to represent the black hole. And that's why people don't use plain Chebyshev functions to represent binary black holes. There are other discretization methods, other basis functions that are much more useful in that case. Mm. Let's also look at the error in the derivative, just for fun. So this was d sine and sine prime. And this is now, this is the fourth Chebyshev function, right? Yes, because the derivative, of course, contains the fourth Chebyshev function. But because our approximation didn't have the fifth Chebyshev function, the derivative that we have doesn't have the fourth Chebyshev function. That was the coefficient that always set to 0. That was the row in the matrix representation, the bottom row, that was always 0. It shouldn't be 0, but we don't have the higher order terms. So this is why the error here looks like this. OK, so this was, now we have two steps in our program today. Oh, I forgot. When does the lecture end? Is it 12 o'clock, 12:15?
11:45, usually.
11:45?
Yeah, but like.
OK, no, that's fine. All right, it started at 10:30. OK, yes, makes sense. Thank you. OK, so we are now two steps in. First was generally representing a functions by expanding it into basis functions. And second, we expanded a particular operator, the derivative operator. And as a next step, I want to represent the boundary operator. One typically does not speak of boundary operators. But if you have a function and a PDE and you want to solve it, you apply a boundary condition. And technically what you do, although you typically don't express it that way, there's a boundary operator that takes the function and projects it onto the boundary. And this is how you apply a boundary condition. You take your function, you apply the boundary operator, and then it should be equal to something. It's like you take a function, you apply a derivative operator, and then it should be equal to something to the right-hand side. So here I'm going to define a boundary operator. So in continuum analytics, I've never heard the expression boundary operator. But when you discretize something and look for consistency, then boundary operator is actually used there. And if you think about integration by parts, then there is the boundary term. And that is usually written in square brackets, which means evaluated at the boundary. You look at me with large eyes. You know integration by parts, obviously, and you know the bracket notation. Yes, yes, I'll just assume that you do. So these square brackets, that would be the boundary operator. That means the function evaluated at the boundary operator. It's kind of like an integral. And inside, there's a delta function, a Dirac delta at the boundary that extracts the boundary values. Define boundary operator. Yeah, let's just do that here. And that evaluates a function at the boundary. So here we have an interval. The interval has two boundary points. So the boundary operator, it needs to return the two values at the boundary. And that is the boundary operator. In our case, since it's an operator and it's going from our vector space, which has five elements in the basis, it will be an operator that has a kernel of dimension 3 because it returns two values. How should I?
What dimension?
Our basis has dimension 5.
Yeah.
There are two boundary points that the boundary operator extracts. Since the boundary operator, since it's an operator there, needs to return 5 elements, something of dimension 5. Since we define it like that, it will have a kernel of dimension 3. Just because we define the boundary operator to return something living in the same function space. Maybe I should draw a sketch on the blackboard here. If you want, can you change the lighting so that it's easier to see? You would go to lecture. Wow, thank you. OK, so this is our domain here. So we have minus 1, and here plus 1, and you have a function that lives here. And we can either expand that function into 5 basis elements, but there's also another way of representing it by sampling the function at 5 particular points. I haven't chosen that. That's just a different basis representation that works rather well for Chebyshev functions. And there would be one point here, and 5 others. Oh, that would be here. But they're not equidistributed. They're kind of clustered at the boundary, something here, end here. And yes, and so if we project this function onto its boundary, then what we would get is something that is non-zero here, non-zero here, and zero at these other three points. So if you do it in the continuum, of course, then that function looks like this. So it has two Dirac deltas just on the boundary. Everything is zero. But since we only have five basis function, we don't have the continuum, everything looks a bit more fuzzy. So the way we represent that function, that looks then a bit probably, oh, let me just sketch that. So it's non-zero here and zero on these other points. Hesh. Oof. I'm trying to draw a function that is goes through all these points and has sufficiently many wiggles in there. Does that work? Let me just try that. Yeah, no, it didn't work. But you know what I mean. So this is what the boundary operator would make of our function. It would return something that is non-zero at the boundary. It keeps the boundary values, but kind of projects the interior to zero. But since the function that we have, I mean, it needs to be represented as a polynomial and needs to be kind of zero in the interior, you would get something like that. But I should really think more about how that actually looks like. Actually, we can just ask Mathematica how it will look like in the end. Thank you. Can we go back to the presentation on the slide?
Because you have three points in the boundary, and then you drew four. That's why.
Yes, but it needs to work with five as well, because I'm using five basis functions. But yes, exactly. I need to have an even number of points to make the sketch work nicely. So we'll see what Mathematica does in the end. So this boundary operator B, we define it here in a very similar way to the derivative operator. So first we take a generic set of coefficients. Yeah, typing is surprisingly complicated here, which is this one. Then we reconstruct a generic function, which is C to F of CS, which is this one here. And then what did I do here? OK. Evaluate function at boundary. Which is C to F of CS. So this is the function. We can evaluate it at minus 1. Then it has this value. We can evaluate it at plus 1, where it has another value. And we can evaluate it at two points. Then we pass in a list of points. And now we get out a list of function values. And if we add a matrix form, it looks nice. So these are the boundary values of the generic function that we defined with these coefficients. And you know, since all the Chebyshev functions are plus 1 or minus 1 at the boundaries, except the zeroth one that are pescally redefined by rescaling it and so on, that means the values at the boundary is just either the sum of all the boundary function at the right boundary, all the Chebyshev polynomials are 1, and at the left boundary, they're alternatingly plus and minus 1, so the boundary value is just the alternating sum of the values over there, times that square root of 2 factor. Mm. Yes?
I have a question. When we projected our generic function first, we get the Chebyshev coefficients.
Yes.
But we knew, for example, in the full problem, we knew about boundary conditions of the function, of full function. When we project and then we go back, that boundary conditions, we are only using some coefficients.
Yes, that's true. That's an error. So what we're doing here is just define a boundary operator that works just on our truncated space. But you can make the same point for the derivative operator, because the real function and its derivative, if we project the derivative of the real function into our space, we may get a non-zero coefficient for the fourth Chebyshev polynomial. Whereas if we take the discrete derivative, then we start with something that lives in our truncated space. And then the coefficient for the fourth Chebyshev polynomial is always 0. That's an error that we're making, and that's an unavoidable error. That's the truncation error, and there's no way around that. And similar for the boundary condition here. So in the end, when you solve a PDE, you have to think what the discrete boundary condition should be and in which order you project things and so on. It's like rounding. If you perform a calculation and you have several rounding steps, you need to think about when you round and when not, but you can't do it without rounding, right? You can't write pi or e or something out. And here it's something similar. You have to think about at what points you project. And this is actually crucially important. If you project at the wrong times, things can become unstable. You may introduce an error, and then you project again, and that increases the error. And every step you do, you get an exponential increase, and if you do it in the right order. So this is also where something I don't want to talk about today. But it's crucially important to keep track of things. And it's very good. Very good. Thank you for pointing that out. And so we are doing that here, and then we're getting this operator BB. And this is actually now an operator that only returns a two-dimensional space, not a five-dimensional space. So later we need to prolongate the boundary operator to have something that actually lives in five dimensions. Well, that's compatible with our five-dimensional base. This is then the matrix. So this is BB, already evaluated that. So let's look at that. And this is how it looks like. This is the matrix representation. So yes, well, it corresponds, but just take these coefficients that we have up there in 44 and read off how the coefficients actually look like. And this is then the matrix representation. And now this is we just join, joins lists. So we have a 2x5 array. So we're creating an empty 3x5 array, or actually n minus 1 by n plus 1 array. And we combine them. And this is now what I call BB. So this is the same thing as before, except we prepended these zeros. So now we have a five-dimensional thing. We don't actually need to do that. So technically, we could have done the same thing for the derivative operator. If we take a derivative, we know the highest coefficient is also zero. So technically, we could have said we start with a five-dimensional space, but the derivative operator returns only a four-dimensional space. The second derivative returns only a three-dimensional space. And this, of course, also where the counting comes in a PDE. If you solve a second-order PDE, you need two boundary conditions. In the continuum, it's a bit difficult to see, but in the discrete, you can just count the number of non-zero coefficients that you have. So we have two boundary conditions, say one for the left, one for the right boundary, which is rank 2. We take a second derivative, we lose two coefficients there, we glue them together again, and then we have five coefficients for five unknown. So in the continuum, since you have infinitely many coefficients, the counting is more difficult. But on the discrete, if you have a finite number of coefficients, the counting is actually that simple. You need to have exactly as many unknowns as equations. So the operator that you're solving corresponding to the BDE cannot have any, the kernel needs to be zero dimensional. So let's take the derivative operator and the boundary operator and add that this does not make sense, right? You want to take the second derivative and add them together. Which then looks like this. So the second derivative operator had the two last rows 0, and now I just added BB1, and now we have a matrix that has actually full rank. And instead of adding them and extending them, I could have just glued the corresponding matrices together as well. Okay, so this was the representation of a derivative operator, which I think is straightforward, that is necessary to solve a PDE, of the boundary operator. That was a bit of a fancy thing to do because you're probably not used to thinking of extracting the boundary via an operator. And the next step is now actually beginning to solve a PDE, actually just to represent a PDE, a partial differential equations in this context.
I have a question. Yes? Why do we make that operator the DD.DD plus BB1?
Oh, I just wanted to show how it looks like. In the end, later on, we will reconstruct an operator for our PDE. Okay. So our PDE, we're going to solve a linear PDE, and that is some operator times the function for which we solve for its discrete representation equals right-hand side. And this combined operator for the complete PDE that will look very similar to this one here. Because you're going to have a second derivative in there, and we're going to have boundary conditions. So we're going to need to combine that.
Why wouldn't we add the boundary conditions as like a second set of equations in the equations that we're solving?
What we want to do in the end, here in this case, it's a linear PDE that we want to solve for simplicity, of course. So we want to get a linear system of equations. And this linear system of equations, we want to have one complete linear system of equations, all the equations that we have combined. And there's one operator for that, and we want to get that matrix representation of this one, okay. Of this one operator. And when you construct the operator, it has two parts, the differential equation part and the boundary condition part. And of course, there could be other algebraic conditions and so on as well. And this one combined operator that comes out, this is going to be looking like that. So here. So we want to solve this PDE. How does it look like? F double prime of x equals right hand side of x, right? Now let's write it out, sine of pi x. So this is the equation we want to solve. I'm just making that up. So it's some function. I take a second derivative, and I choose the right-hand side to make it more interesting. And we also, actually, we also should specify the boundary conditions here. And we want to give boundary conditions for the function value. You can give other kinds of boundary conditions, as for example, for Neumann boundary conditions or Wobab, whatever, linear combinations or something. But that's the simplest case here. And that, of course, setting the function on the left side to f0, that is a linear condition. And when we have the full function, then we take the boundary operator, which is a linear operator, to extract the value on the left-hand side and set it to something else that's going to be a linear equation. So here we define the right-hand side just as a function in the continuum. Obviously, I'm going to solve this equation in two ways. I'm going to ask Mathematica to get the true solution, and I'm going to get the approximate solution via the approximation that we defined, and then we can compare and look at the error. So first, I start by the continuum condition, and that is the right-hand side of the function up here, which is just sine of pi x. And what is this one here? Probably just something for testing a simpler condition. Maybe it didn't work in the beginning. Let's just ignore that. And this is how the right-hand side looks like. It's just, well, a sine wave compressed to the interval minus 1 plus plus 1. Define differential equation. So our differential equation is that the second derivative of f of x is equal to the right-hand side. And I call this condition DEQ, the differential equation. And here I define the boundary conditions, ECS, because there are two boundary conditions. F of minus 1 is 1 over 10, and f of plus 1 is 0. Analytic solution, this is, of course, what Mathematica is good at. And of course, in this simple toy example, we wouldn't need to do any of the complicated stuff. So the analytic solution, so here we join the differential equation, which are turned into a list of differential equations, a list of length 1. And we add the boundary conditions. There are two boundary conditions. So altogether, we now have three equations that make up the differential equation that we want to solve. And we want to solve it for f, and our unknown is x. So we just call d solve of it, and a solve is the analytic solution. Now, there's just one analytic solution that Mathematica has. So we just take our total list of equations, the differential equation and the boundary conditions. We put in that first analytic solution and simplify it. And the result is 2, 2, 2. That means our solution actually solves the differential equation. So this DEQ and the BCS, that's all a set of equations. And if you have a complicated set of equations and you ask Mathematica to simplify it, and the result is true, that then well, obviously the equation holds. We can also leave out the simplify here. Doesn't work. Okay. Yes, it does. And we look at the analytic solution. So we take f of x and we plug in our analytic solution and show that on our interval. And this is how the solution looks like. And you see, at the right boundary, the solution is 0. At the left boundary, the solution is 1 over 10. And the curvature of the solution, the second derivative, is just the sine of pi x. Is that the case? Yes, sine of pi x would be minus 1 here. So the second derivative is probably minus 1 here. Sine pi x is 0 here. So indeed, there's no curvature here, just the slope. And the curvature is plus 1 here. So that's indeed the solution that we're looking for. Now let's try to repeat that numerically. So let's do this in step. So Sorry. Uh-huh. Mathematica also has built-in numerical methods. It does not only do analytical work. But I don't know what representation Mathematica uses internally. I don't think it uses Chebyshev functions. It probably uses a piecewise polynomial approximation for certain functions. But we can do that. So to solve that, you call nd-solve. That's the numerical solve for differential equations. And in many cases where d-solve can't find a solution anymore, nd-solve does find a solution or can find an approximate solution. D-solve has many options. You should look at that for different ways for how Mathematica can try to solve a differential equation. nd-solve has even more options for initial conditions, approximation values, error thresholds, iteration numbers, and so on and so forth. I'm not showing that here. In many cases, d-solve and nd-solve can only solve ODEs, not PDEs. See, here we have just a one-dimensional domain, making this an ODE, making it much easier to solve analytically. Our method works very well, even if you have multi-dimensional domains. If you have three or four dimensions, if you were to solve the Einstein equations and so on, we could, in principle, use the same method. It would go through in a straightforward manner. But of course, finding an analytic solution, that would not work anymore. And nd-solve is also likely to have problems in that case. So here's an interpolating function that is Mathematica's representation, probably of a piecewise polynomial representation of a function. And we can plot that. And it's the same thing as above, because well, it's a simple function. So Mathematica can find a very good piecewise polynomial approximation. And well, piecewise polynomial, that's exactly what we're doing in Chebyshev as well, as one piece and a polynomial. So this was showing off Mathematica. Now I'm trying to do the same thing, except in a much more complicated manner, except the method is more generic and works in many more cases. So we're going to do this in multiple steps. First, we are going to take the conditions that we have, take the differential equation and boundary condition, and find their matrix representation. For our basis. And then we have a linear equation. So we just solve this as linear equation. It's just the matrix equation that we then get that, which is the easy part. So the step first is the difficult part. So first we take the right-hand side. And we project the right-hand side onto all basis functions. And you know how that looks like. We take the right-hand side and we project it. And it looks like this, which is complicated. And we don't want to deal with Bessel functions. We'd want to do it completely numerically. So we just evaluate that as we did above. And this is then the particular representation. We can also look at that. So we take our representation, reconstruct the function with C to F, evaluate it at x, and so on, and plot it. And what is this? So I called it DRHS because that's the discretized right-hand side. And I'm surprised here a bit that the error is so large. I mean, you can obviously see the error. Apparently, the right-hand side that we choose is not well represented with just four Chebyshev polynomials. Apparently, we should have taken a few more to get a good representation. But that's good. That shows that the method that we have has an error. We just need to increase the number n, which we can do later. Now we project also the boundary conditions. Well, it was easy, right? One boundary condition is 1 over 10. The other one is 0. So obviously, it just becomes 0.1 and 0 if we do that. Now, this, of course, would work also in a more general way if we had a more complicated boundary condition. This just takes the boundary values. This is the expression f on the left boundary, f on the right boundary. We put the boundary condition, which we have as a, what's it called? It's a replacement pattern that this one defines here. And should explain that. OK, this is the boundary condition. And it's in the written in a form A equals B, left-hand side equals right-hand side. And I convert that into a pattern, which then becomes left-hand side error, right-hand side. Then we have the boundary condition as a replacement pattern. And that pattern we then apply onto these function values. It's just, I don't know why I was so fancy when I wrote it down, when I could have just checked the values 1 over 10 and 0 and put them in here right away. Now we have now I really should have written some comments in there to understand what I'm doing here. OK, what I'm doing here is taking the two conditions there for the actual equations that I'm trying to solve, the differential equation and the boundary conditions, and I'm combining them. So this take first n minus 1 conditions from the differential equation. This and adds the replaces the last two terms with 0 here. And here, take two conditions from boundary conditions. And then I add the corresponding conditions together for the right-hand side and for the left-hand side. And this is the operator that we talked about before. That is the second derivative plus the boundary conditions. Here I add them together. I could have also just have stitched them together and solve this. Stitch. Is that correct? No. There's a T missing, right? Yes. Actually, I can just and solve them. Mathematica is a function linear solve, that would be the same routine that also, I mean, it just solves the linear system of equation that is given as a matrix. So here, this is the operator on the left-hand side, derivative operator and boundary operator, and this is the right-hand side. This is the right-hand side for the differential equation, and this is the right-hand side for the boundary conditions, which is this value, 1 over 10 and 0, and this is then the particular solution, and this is then show the solution, and it what is this? This is the analytic solution and our solution. I think blue is the analytic solution and red is our solution. So the yellow one. Okay, not very good. Okay, so either I made a mistake somewhere, but I don't think so, because you would have caught my mistakes, right? Right? Or we didn't use enough collocation points, enough ansatz functions. So let's increase the n to 10. Well, let's increase it to 6 in the beginning.
So what's DD1 again?
Pardon?
If we go back down. So the first one, that's the boundary one. Okay.
The boundary condition is well represented.
No, but in linear solved, it's the second derivative plus. I was wondering what BB1 is, but.
BB1 is the boundary condition.
Yeah.
And BB is the boundary condition, and BB1 is just the extended one that has zeros added to it. Okay, so let's set n to 6, and there is, well, just for good measure, let's quit the kernel before we do that. No! What is that? Oof, very good. Same as yesterday. And then evaluate notebook that goes through the whole notebook. Now this will take a few minutes because it does all the now you see we're using more Chebyshev polynomials. What's happening here? Why does it take so long? You see where Mathematica is currently working. It's the bold things. Once Mathematica is finished, it jumps down. Of course, all the examples that I gave are also going to be re-evaluated. And I mentioned before that, for example, the matrix representation of the derivative operator, one knows how it looks like. You don't need to spend all the time asking all these integrals to be solved for particular values of I and j. It takes a bit. Let's just wait and let's hope that the error actually goes down. Oh no, we should have, okay, quick, before anything happens, I'm going to take this one here, copy, and paste it down here, so that I hope it won't be overwritten when Mathematica re-evaluates that. No, that's not good. You see, in the notebook, you can interact with the notebook, you can type anything, but of course, Mathematica won't evaluate anything while it's working on its own things. Now, my laptop is beginning to run hot. Where is it currently? Still projecting the sine function here. I was really hoping this would be faster. This was all the fast. Is it done now? I think it's done. Yes?
Yeah.
Okay, and I tried to save the solution. Actually, maybe it's still in the buffer. Yes, very good, very good. So I was able to paste the old solution, which looked rather bad, and the new solution, which now looks much better. So it's still a bit shifted to the left, but the maximum and minimum, they almost agree, and we use 6 basis functions. And once we use 10 basis functions, or probably even already when we use 8 basis functions, it would look much better. And of course, apart from the straightforward and thus rather stupid way of defining certain things, this method would be really efficient. Now, what we need to do is take our initial conditions and we project them onto the Chebyshev basis functions. This is the slow part that we're currently doing. And there is actually a faster part that is almost as accurate by evaluating the function just at certain points, like a Gaussian quadrature rule, and then you don't know it's actually the Bessel function, but you get the respective basis coefficients approximately in a much faster way. And if you do that, then it would take a millisecond to do that, or less to do that, and then you could use 20 coefficients, and it would be much faster than anything here. But I don't want to go into that. Are you familiar with Gauss quadrature? If you want to solve an integral, and you want to do that numerically, then you can choose a few particular points that you evaluate the function, and then you get the result. And of course, you can just use 100 equispace points and do that and sum up all the contributions with whatever German is called Obersummen and Untersummen, but I'm sure they're corresponding English words. But there are much more clever ways to do that and to combine the respective functions. If you spread the functions, the values, well, you evaluate the function in a more clever way. And Gauss and Lobato are particular good methods to do that. OK, very good. This was this. Do you have questions on this method? Did it all make sense?
How would the stitching work if you had also a first derivative? If it was a second order differential equation, but also a first order derivative in it.
So if you have...
Because you still have two boundary conditions.
Well, if you have a PDE that has only a first derivative, then you can only give one boundary condition.
Sure, but what if I have like...
A second derivative and a first derivative?
Yeah, like a driven harmonic oscillator or something like that.
Good point. I think what would happen in that case is that the equations that you're getting are linearly dependent of each other. So I'm currently just adding them. Stitching together is another way to combine matrices. But in reality, what you need to find is a certain number of linearly independent equations. And if you're a bit clever, have good luck, you can just add things together in a clever way to make them work. But otherwise, you're ending up with a system that has, say, n plus 2 equations for n unknowns, but you know the n plus 2 are actually linearly dependent of each other. So then, I mean, there are methods to do that numerically, or you need to look at eigenvalue singular values or something, but it's complicated that you can do that. I think the regular way to solve a linear system would already work. So if you solve it in a least squares manner, you would automatically get the unique solution, for example. Yeah, I think there's some technical problems that I'm skipping over here. Thank you.
So if you have functions, say, from two-dimensional spaces or higher dimensional,
yes,
the boundary operator, would you still be able to write like this?
The boundary operator then becomes more complicated because, say, you have a two-dimensional function like this, and let's just assume we have just three collocation points in every direction, then, but in this case, the boundary operator would have eight.
You just choose some points on the boundary.
Yes, in one direction, but in two directions, the boundary, in two dimensions, the boundary is actually one-dimensional. Yeah. So the boundary becomes much more important. But if you count the number of degrees of freedom and the dimension of the kernel of the derivative operator and so on, things still match up nicely, match up exactly.
Wouldn't you just like have to decompose like the desired, like the boundary would be like a function, right, on the boundary of your domain? And so
it depends on how you give the boundary condition, how you specify it. But yes, you can specify a function on the boundary and then do that. Yes.
Yeah. And then so would you have to decompose that in the boundaries of the basis functions? Is that how that would work? Because you could only...
Oh, because it's not values. Yes. One thing you can do is you can define a function space for the boundary and then project onto that function space.
Yeah.
But you can also take the boundary conditions and express it right away in the two-dimensional function space. So you can define the boundaries as a 2D function, essentially, that depends on X and Y, but you're only looking at the value of the outer boundary. That's not how one usually thinks about it, but it would work like that. And then it doesn't matter what you specify in the interior, because the boundary operator just means that you only look at the boundary values and at their solution on the boundary, and there they must agree. Mm-hmm. And in the interior, and of course outside the domain, it doesn't matter what values you have. Okay. So I want to stress one more thing. What we did here is essentially take functions which are analytic, and we just converted it to basic linear algebra, finite dimensional vector spaces of real or complex numbers. And this is what one does technically as well. And this is why linear algebra is so incredibly important in computer science and in numerical analysis and in high performance computing as well. I wanted to make another point that escaped myself. Okay. So technically, there is a tutorial session scheduled for this afternoon. They also have, unfortunately, a conflicting appointment there. And are you aware of the, what's it called, social hour on Friday afternoons?
Yeah, but we can never make them.
Yeah, today you can. Because I have to cancel the tutorial for today. There will be two more lectures, Monday and Friday next week. But this afternoon, there will not be a tutorial. If you have questions on Mathematica or anything, of course, you're always free to just email me and stop by my office, number 350. Apart from that, I'll see you next week on Thursday.